Today's episode is brought to you by Wise, the account that helps you manage your money around the world, which is huge for travelers. I've been a customer and a fan for 10 years. The Wise account helps you send, spend, and receive in different currencies fast, and they do it all without hidden fees or exchange rate markups. This service has been so critical for me in my life as a traveler, as a nomad, as somebody living abroad. And you can join 16 million customers and learn how the Wise account can help you out on the road at wise.com/travel. That's Wise, WISE.com/travel, or download the app. This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Tony Giles is a blind and partially deaf independent traveler who has visited 130 countries on 7 different continents and counting, many as a solo traveler. He's written 3 books, delivered an epic TED Talk, and been featured on major media all over the world, from the BBC to Travel and Leisure. You might find his story incredibly inspiring. I know I do. But Tony doesn't really see it that way.
I don't think they're really going to get how a blind person travels and see the world. Because when you're sighted, in your mind as a sighted person, the worst disability is losing your sight. People think, if I lose my sight, I can't do anything. I can't work anymore. They imagine in their head, how can they cope? How can they do? As I know, it's not that difficult. But because I've never had sight, really. So what I do is normal. People say to me, oh, you're inspiring and your story is amazing. And I get it, it is. But to me, it's not. It's just what I do.
Travel is indeed what Tony does. He is actively working on visiting every country in the world. But it wasn't that easy in the beginning. During our chat, Tony shares a pivotal moment in New Orleans that changed everything for him.
I suddenly thought, I'm totally blind, severely deaf, in a strange, unknown, dangerous city. How the hell am I going to find the tram stop? How am I going to even get around?
Tony Giles, blind world traveler and author, is our guest today. Thanks for being here and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey there, it's Jason with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms, to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. So excited to bring you this one. Been waiting to release it, my conversation with Tony Giles. You can check out his work at tonythetraveler.com. That's traveler with 2 L's. If you're wondering how this interview took place, it's because Tony wears digital aids. These give him roughly 80% hearing capacity in a one-to-one conversation. We've recorded our chat over Zoom. And during this conversation, he openly shares some of the challenges he faced at an early age, learning how to live with his visual and hearing impairments. And I was fascinated to discover how Tony, as a totally blind and partially deaf individual, experiences the world as a traveler, how he engages all of his senses when he travels, how he allows his body to feel the authenticity of a place. A lot of lessons for all travelers here. And Tony's doing all of this world wandering as an independent traveler. A lot of the trips he's done are solo trips. He is working on visiting every country in the world, and he has to rely on the help of strangers. So you'll hear why, surprisingly, he doesn't find that to be a very difficult thing to do. And he's a hilarious guy. I love his sense of humor. And as you'll hear, he didn't set out to be this great inspiration, but just through the way he lives his life, he is. He is, at least to me. And I think you'll find the same. Gave me a lot to think about, a lot of new perspectives to consider. And also enjoyed hearing his travel advice. Of course, we talked some destination talk. When somebody's been to that many places, you want to hear their recommendations. So we get into all of that and much more right now. Please enjoy my conversation with the wonderful Tony Giles. I'll see you on the other side. I'll share one of the moments from this interview that really pumped me up. Might do the same for you. And I'll send you off with a quote for the day. Thanks for listening. And please enjoy my chat with Tony. Tony Giles, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
A pleasure to have you. I've been meaning to reach out for a while. We finally got in touch and got in touch through a mutual friend because you guys were, you were just at the Extraordinary Travelers Conference in Armenia. Was that your first time in Armenia?
Second time in Armenia. I went back in 2010, got some friends invite me to Georgia. So they were working, so I figured I'd head to Armenia. I actually tried to go to Azerbaijan first, but they wouldn't give me a visa. So, I wanted to cross by overland. They wouldn't give me a visa, so I went down to Armenia.
Have things gotten more complicated because of Brexit and all that with visas?
In some countries, I've been planning a trip to Africa soon for Sao Tome and Principe and then Gambia. So it looks like some of the countries are asking you to get a visa in your own country right now rather than on the border. But Armenia, I don't need a visa, so that's good. Fly straight in.
Well, since that's your most recent sort of trip, can you tell us a bit about what you did there?
Yeah, so I flew in to Armenia on the 11th of October via Vienna. And my mum helps me book flights because the website's a bit tricky. I use a screen reading software on my laptop called Jaws. And it speaks, press a key, so I can use the internet with the arrow keys and stuff. So once in Armenia, and one of the organizers booked me a hostel. So somebody met me, and then they took me to the hostel. And then 3 days of the conference, from the Friday the 13th to the 15th, and I was the first speaker. So I was up first, and I opened my speech with, traveling is like sex. If you talk about it too much, you never do it. Yeah. That woke everyone up.
Classic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just told stories after that. I tried to explain how I see the world through using all my senses of my body rather than my sight or my, I'm totally blind. So yeah, I was born with a rare eye condition, which meant I couldn't open my eyes for the first 3 years of my life. And then when I was given dark glasses around the age of 3, I could then open my eyes. But I'm very light sensitive, so I could see shapes and shadows about the age of 12. And then my eye condition not changed, but my sensitivity to light lessened about the age of sort of 12 or 13. I was totally blind. But I'd seen shapes and shadows. I had some ideas of what objects looked like. And I understood shade. So when I looked at the balls on the pool table, I could tell the black ball was the blackest and the red ball was slightly lighter, blue ball was slightly lighter. I had that basic understanding of shape and shades and stuff. So I told them about that really and then just explained how I traveled and I go to visit a country for the different smells, the music, new food, meeting different people. And it's about talking to people and learning about their culture. And I sort of say you don't need to be blind to do that.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to get into some of those stories. Was it when you were 13, did you say, when you kind of it went from sort of the shapes and...
Yeah, so at the age of 3, I could see and sort of sense shapes. And I could actually sense big black letters on white paper. I could sense the contrast. I don't have any color nerves, but I have my black and white nerves. So like when you go into a cinema, a dim light, so I could sense the contrast. And then as I got older, the prints I was writing got smaller and then I just stopped looking. I stopped using my lenses because it was too difficult. And about the age, I don't really remember, but sort of 11, 12, 13, that any sensory vision I had is really gone. The only thing I could sort of sense was sort of sunlight when it was very bright. And then I don't really even sense that now. But the optic nerve still actually works because that part isn't damaged. So it's a bit complicated. And then I also went deaf when I was 5. Slightly deaf in both ears, and again, it's nerve damage. And that's got worse over years, but I use digital hearing aids. So one-to-one, I hear really good, and then in a crowd, it gets more difficult. the challenge for me is because I can't lip read, but I don't have the sight and I can't sign. So it's the combination.
When you're getting into your teen years at that time, it's like sort of complicated. Life is sort of confusing and complicated anyway. So how was that time period emotionally for you when you were thinking about your life going forward?
And that was the toughest time, especially with sort of the age of 14, 15 up to sort of 18, 19, trying to pick up girls and stuff, not being able to see, not being able to hear the idea of, they don't find me attractive because blah, 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 being blind and deaf. And then eventually getting my head around that. And I started drinking when I was 17. I was pretty wild by the age of sort of 21, 22. But then I realized through my travels and meeting more and more people, I realized one day, well, these people actually like me for who I am, not because I'm blind or they feel sorry for me. And yeah, once I stopped drinking, then I could sort of analyze stuff. That's 23, 24 by then, and sort of realized, I was an okay person. So, been on this journey, as people say.
Yeah, was it like so much of a problem that you sort of had to kind of quit? And
yeah, it was killing me. I had to quit.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, 2001, I went to Australia, and the day I landed in Australia, I'd finished university and I had a general medical GP, and they discovered I got kidney disease. And I didn't think a lot about it, that'd be fine, and just drank. And then 5 months later, I saw a consultant and he said, if you don't get treatment and reduce your drinking, you'll be dead within 3 years. I went, okay. So I decided, I went to see a close friend and they said, the drinking is affecting our relationship. And that made me think about things a lot. And I thought, just slow down and maybe just 2 or 3 beers a day. And I realized I couldn't, if I had 3 or 4, I'd have 10. I realized I had to quit completely. Came off it slowly. And then, eventually realized it's better to be clean.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially where you're from, there's such a culture around, going to get a pint and, that doesn't help.
No, my dad made his home beer at home when I was 7 and I taste it and then going to university. I went to bars to listen to music rather than drink when I started. I didn't really like the taste of beer, but I liked cider. And then I discovered whiskey and then it was a whole different ballgame. The old laughing lady. And it's funny because after I stopped drinking and then I traveled, it was difficult at first being around people drinking. But I actually see people absolutely paralytic. And that's what I was like. So, my God. Yeah. And I've been sober for 20 years now.
Wow. Congratulations, man.
Yeah. Better for it. Yeah.
I imagine, in a lot of ways, like the way you described it, at least, it's a kind of a coping mechanism, right?
Yeah, I think an escapism to try and blot out the anger I was feeling and the pain. And I lost people from, I lost my dad when I was 16 and my best friend when I was 16. But plus issues around being blind and deaf and, trying to get laid and failing and all that. Yeah, it all hit at the same time, really. Just life.
Yeah, well, just life. But that's a lot. That's a lot for anybody to deal with, man.
But it could have been worse. I was very lucky. I went to a boarding school when I was 10, about 200, 300 miles from my home. And there were other children there who were visually impaired. But, my best friend was in a wheelchair. When I met him, he could move his hands and drive his own wheelchair. And when he died 6 years later, he couldn't move anything. Like, later on, once I started, I realized, so lucky to be able to walk around and scratch my ass or just the simple thing, It's time. You just need time. And once you can mature, then you can realize, I feel I'm very lucky. I spent the last 25 years, traveling the world, meeting amazing people, doing amazing things. I understand and appreciate I am very lucky and fortunate to do what I do. But it has its challenges. And there are times when it's very difficult and times when I have to sort of reset and go home and start again. But this is what I want to do. People say, isn't traveling difficult if you're blind, if you can't see? I said, yes, but it's only as difficult or as easy as your mind makes it. Most of it's in the head. Most of it's in the mind. And no one's forcing me to go traveling. I do it because I enjoy it and I love the challenge. So,
yeah. I watched your TED Talk, by the way. Incredible. I'm going to link up to it in the show notes because it's literally the best TED Talk I've ever seen. It's so great, so inspiring, hilarious. Some great jokes in there. You talked about that moment in New Orleans when you had the decision. I was wondering if you could just kind of share that moment with people, because that seems like the pivotal moment for you when you kind of went all in on travel.
That was the first one, and then it was the second one several years later. But yeah, the basic was I was studying in the States, a part of an American studies degree, and got sent to South Carolina. And spring break, a week off, all my friends went down to Florida, and I thought, not going to let me drink, take drugs, or, you know. I thought, let's go to New Orleans. That's, you know, I'd heard about the blues and the jazz, Bourbon Street. Well, that'd be fun. So I got friends help me book a flight, book a hostel. I've been backpacking around the UK for 5 or 6 years, hostels and that. And so that landed in New Orleans, got a taxi to the hostel, no problem. Went up the steps, checked in, and then asked the staff how to get to Bourbon Street, the main, you know, party street in New Orleans. They said, fine, you walk down the steps, you turn left, you walk 4 blocks, find a tram. Okay, no problem. I walked out the hostel, went down the steps, onto the street, and just froze. And I was, what, 21 by then? Almost 22, and I just panicked. You know, I don't know what, 90 Fahrenheit and 98 for humidity, and I just, it wasn't heat. I just panicked. I suddenly thought, I'm totally blind, severely deaf, in a strange, unknown, dangerous city. How the hell am I going to find the tram stop? How am I going to even get around? And my whole body was just shaking. I can't do this. I took a few deep breaths. I said to myself, Tony, this is what you want. This is what you come to do. If you don't want that challenge, go home. So I took a few more deep breaths, turned left, walked up the street 4 blocks, asked someone to show me to the tram stop, went down to Bourbon Street and had a blast. And I don't really remember much about the rest of my week in New Orleans. And that's been my attitude ever since, really.
Mm. Well, what was the second? You mentioned that there was a second.
Yeah, there was a second one there. So I traveled around and I went back to studying, and then I later went to California with an Australian girl. And later I ended up in Hawaii by myself. It's quite hilarious. And then I traveled and I realized my kidneys were getting worse. Eventually, luckily, we were able to find a donor. And so I figured I'd just travel. At that time, I was looking for work, or voluntary work. But each time I sort of got an interview, but my kidneys were getting worse. I thought, oh, I like traveling, but how much longer have I got? And I figured I'd just travel until I was on dialysis, artificial kidney function. But in 2008, I was able to have a transplant. December 2008 was successful. My stepdad gave me a kidney because we were a match. And when I was in hospital and I had a new kidney, and once you have a new kidney, it's like putting a new battery in a car. You suddenly got lots of energy. And I just said to myself, let's do this traveling thing for the rest of my life and try and get to all 193 countries. That's what I've been doing ever since. Really.
Unbelievable. You've been to, I mean, at least according to your website, tonythetraveler.com, I'm going to link to all this, but it looks like 150 or 128 of the UN records.
That's right, 128 of the UN ones. And then, yeah, I had another 20 odd sort of. Kosovo is not recognized, Western Sahara, Greenland, some of them part of Denmark, some part of France, yeah, things like that. So, yeah.
Well, when did the idea for traveling kind of start for you?
Like I say in my talks, I didn't wake up one day like a lot of people. All right, let's go traveling for a year. You know, in between uni and college.
Like a gap year thing. That's typical in England, right? It's a lot of people do that.
Exactly. I didn't have friends to go with because everyone's doing different things. Basically, I got introduced to sort of traveling, the idea of journeying through my dad's stories. He was in the Merchant Navy in the late 1940s, early 50s, before I was born. And I remember him telling his story that crossing Australia from the east coast to the west coast by steam train and taking 8 days. That sounded interesting. And then also traveling up the St. Lawrence River, icebergs floating down the ship's sides and stuff. And that sounded adventurous and exciting to me. I was 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that. And then, so that was it. And then when I went to boarding school, my first kind of ambition, my first kind of goal was, once I had mobility training, which is learning to use a white cane to get about, find objects on the ground and stuff. And then go up and down steps safely and eventually cross roads. My first goal was to try and get home and see my family as much as possible. Very close to my mum. My dad was quite old and was in ill health. So that was the kind of first thing, really. But the thing that really sort of started the traveling abroad and the idea of visiting other countries was got to go to Boston in the US with my school when I was 16. And that was totally different. I mean, I've been to London several times. I've been to a Greek island with my parents, but going to the States was different. People talked differently. They were more direct. The traffic went in different directions. Everything was bigger. You know, I could sense the space around me through my body. And the pavements or the sidewalks, as you call them, were, you know, huge compared to the ones in England. And it was just different. There was an atmosphere. I'd not experienced it. I thought, I want more of this. So I went back. And then it sort of started from then. And then really the next kick was, you know, traveling and studying in the States in 2000. And then from there, I planned a trip to Australia and New Zealand because I studied about the Vietnam Wars, the conflict. So I thought I wanted to go to Vietnam. I wanted to be there for the Tet New Year, the Lunar New Year. So I thought, well, I can't sit on my bum for 6 months. I thought, let's go to Australia and New Zealand because, you know, I'd heard about Australia and read about Australia through my studies and listening to sport cricket on the radio. So I knew where the main cities were. And also at my school, we had tactile maps of the continents. So basically, it's made of plastic, and the oceans were sort of smooth plastic, and then the land masses were raised sort of shapes. So I could see the shape of the continent, and the rivers were indented lines, and then there'd be a sort of like a big dot with a braille abbreviations next to it to mark the main city. So, you know, something like New York would be NY, or San Francisco would be SS, etc. Los Angeles, LA. You know, in Australia, Sydney, the SY. So, yeah, and I had a big map of Australia. So I could use my fingers to give me the idea of the shape and work out the main cities. And that's what I planned it. And then, yeah, and eventually on that same trip, it was a five-month trip, I was really confident. I could speak to people and travel around and let's go to Vietnam and Thailand. And that was completely different. That was totally new.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. If you love coffee like me, let me tell you how you can get an incredible cup of coffee, whether you're at home or on the road. You can use what I use, which is the AeroPress. Have you seen this? This is a device that uses a patented 3-in-1 brew technology. It combines the flavor benefits of espresso, pour over, and French press into one compact, portable device built for travel or home. The AeroPress has over 55,000 five-star reviews in 60 countries, plus it's the best-reviewed coffee press on the planet. That tells you something, and it makes an incredible gift. Under $50. Get one for yourself or somebody you care about. Pick yours up at aeropress.com/zero to travel. That's AeroPress, AeroPress.com/zero to travel. Use the promo code zero to travel, all one word, to save 20% off your order. That's 20% off. Thank you to AeroPress for the delicious coffee and for supporting today's show. Now, back to the show. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the experience for you, you know, because you have all your ebooks and the sort of the ongoing tagline of the books is My Way. That's right. Like yeah, Southern Africa,
My Way series. Way. Yeah.
Yeah. The My Way series. Yeah. Can you just describe what you mean? Because I know in your TED talk, you said you're engaging all of your senses to discover a place and this idea of seeing the world my way. Can you just describe a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the idea behind it was seeing the world my way was actually my mum's idea. I'd been traveling for about half a dozen years and she said, oh, you should write a book. So my friends could sort of try and understand what you do. I don't want to write a book. I want to travel. So I eventually did. And it's just like therapy. I just wrote everything down that happened through my entire life, the stuff I could remember. And then I emailed people the stuff I couldn't remember. And eventually ended up with a huge manuscript, about 200,000 words. All right. I broke it down and basically came up with this book that looked reasonably good. And I thought, no one's going to publish this. So I shoved it in a drawer. Well, a laptop drawer. And then one of my friends saw an article for a new publisher. So I sent the manuscript to them. And I had the idea because one of my favorite songs was seen, I did it my way. My way, that's a good idea. And I thought, oh, seeing the world my way, that's I see it my way through my unique, not seeing it through my eyes. So it was sort of tongue in cheek. And then, eventually the publisher said, oh, we like this. It's interesting. You need to work a bit more on it. And 18 months later, we had a book and then had a website. Someone suggested I get a website. And then 2010, it came out in print. It did reasonably well, but I still had all this extra material. Like, wow, some of it is still quite good. So eventually came out with a second one, but they didn't want to publish it. So I said, so, and the idea behind it really was just to tell my story and show people that despite being blind and deaf, or despite being whatever disabilities you might have, physical or mental, you can achieve your goals, you can live your dreams. It might not be traveling around the world doing crazy things, 10 months a year, but it's just about having a go, really. And if you fail, have a go again. Never a desire to make money, because you don't. That was about it. And then the second one led to a third, really. So that was the idea. And then, trying to describe how I see the world using the sense of smell, my sense of touch, my whole body, trying to describe how I sense space. So I walk into a room and I can feel the shape of the room through my body, through the air and the energy. And if I'm walking through a forest, the space is quite tight, quite small, like walking through an alleyway. And then suddenly I might enter a field and suddenly the space in front of me opens up, the wind picks up and the echo's different, or it's a bit hard to describe. But yeah, that's how I sense my surroundings. And I go hiking and surely hiking must be difficult if you're blind. It's easy. Because if you're going upwards or downwards by the gradient, you use your feet and your stick to follow the trail, and you follow the voices of other hikers.
I watched the BBC thing you did, and because one of the things you said when you're walking through the market, you said it feels authentic, and I think it's fascinating to me these body feelings you're getting through your travels. I want you to share a bit more about some of those body feelings you're describing in some places.
So I'm using my skin. I'm using my skin to tell the difference in temperature, whether it's hot or humid. I'm feeling the wind on my face or lack of wind. I'm feeling the different terrain under my feet when I'm walking. My feet are so sensitive. My toes, the soles of my feet, even though I'm wearing shoes and socks. I know if I'm walking on concrete or gravel, or suddenly it's cobbles, it's just a combination. There's never one sense. Like most people, when they're using it primarily their sight, and that gives them 90% of their information, where I'm using my skin, my body, my feet, my hearing, I've got a sense of smell. I can smell onions cooking or meat frying, or maybe I'll smell sewage. And then I'm hearing the hustle and bustle, people shouting in whatever language, and people laughing, people all noise, like if you're walking into a pub and you think, oh, it's very quiet, maybe there's only two people in here. And then you walk into another restaurant and there's all this noise. Like, oh, this is a good place to eat because it's busy. This is, it means the food's probably good. Just little things like that. And echo as well. I echo up my stick when I'm banging it on the ground. So it gives me a sense I might be, walking near a wall. Like I say, I feel the gradient when everyone's suddenly walking downhill or uphill, because the gradient goes up and down.
You mentioned the book kind of being therapy, like getting that 200,000, just getting those 200,000 words down, that first manuscript. In what way was it therapeutic for you?
Because it allowed me to release all my emotions and to express myself, my fears, my doubts, my anger, my hopes, my dreams, in a way that I couldn't do verbally. I couldn't tell my family how I felt about a lot of stuff because they just didn't understand. They're not blind and deaf. I could tell my mum to some degree, but I didn't want to tell my mum all my stuff. I didn't want her to worry. Traveling is good because you can tell strangers a lot of stuff, but it doesn't matter because you'll probably never see them again. So if you offend them, it's not so bad. But telling your family, especially when you're different, you feel so different, which I did when I was younger, much younger than my brother and sister, not spent a lot of time with them when being at boarding school. And I always felt I had to be strong for my others, especially when my dad died. And which, looking back, pretty silly now, but at the time, that's how I felt. And, you know, expressing my sexual frustrations and everything else, writing it down. And, it might have never seen the light of day. I might have never shared it with anyone. And some of the stuff was taken out, obviously. But just getting it down out of my head, or wherever it is, was refreshing, you know.
Were you nervous about sharing it with your family so they could read it and get really understand things better?
Not really. No, once I'd taken out some of the stuff.
Yeah.
If I'd have left it as the original rough manuscript, then yes. I took some stuff that couldn't be published.
Yeah. But you got it out.
I got it out.
For yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it helped. It cleared the air. And I was able to move forward. Yeah. And then the other part of it came through traveling.
You are trying to visit every United Nations recognized sovereign nation,
and more,
right?
Yeah.
And more. So, because that's a jump between, you know, okay, yeah, I want to go experience things and travel as much as I can. And there's that. And then there's, hey, I'm going to try to go to every country in the world, or I am going to every country in the world because I'm confident you're going to do it. So at what point did you kind of go to that next level? Because that's a whole other level, I feel, of a commitment.
As I say, when I was in hospital having my kidney transplant, and once I'd had the new kidney, I had a new lease of life, it's instantly new energy. And
that's when the every country in the world thing started.
Yeah, that's when it challenged with trying to get every country, and the more. And then that evolved again as I started traveling and going to more countries and more difficult countries. Difficult in for anyone. This is the challenge I love. And then it became about not just traveling for me, but also showing people and inspiring people through my talks.
That was what I wanted to ask you about next, because that's another element of this, right? Of your journey. It's not just your personal mission. Like you're writing these books, you're doing these talks, and you've kind of taken on this role of like really inspiring people, which I really appreciate and love. It's not something that everybody wants to do. Not everybody wants to sort of take that charge. Can you just talk a bit about that experience? Like what made you kind of, yeah.
I didn't go looking for it. My idea, I consider myself a very selfish person, or my mum would say self-driven. So. But then it sort of kind of evolved into it really. I was writing, and then people asked me for interviews, and then someone asked me to do a talk, a blind organization, or something called Sense, which is a charity for deaf blind children. And then someone else asked me to do another talk, and then as it eventually got to a stage, and someone asked me to do a TEDx. I thought, wow, what's that TEDx? And I sort of researched it, and then you're going to talk in front of 1,000 people. I thought, well, that sounds good. But yeah, it sort of slowly evolved, and I'm still slightly uncomfortable about doing it. Not so much now, because I thought at the time, but it's especially in front of visually impaired audiences, because I thought you don't want to sort of, you don't want to tell, give the information, because what I do is quite extreme. I thought that scare people rather than inspire them. And then, and the other thing I worried about talking in front of sighted audiences was, I don't think they're really going to get this. I don't think they're really going to get how a blind person travels and see the world, because when you're sighted, in your mind as a sighted person, the worst thing, the worst disability, losing your sight. People think, if I lose my sight, I can't do anything. I can't work anymore. I can't do that. They imagine in their head, how can they cope? How can they do? As I know, it's not that difficult. But because I've never had sight, really. So what I do is normal. People say to me, oh, you're inspiring and your story is amazing. And I get it, it is. But to me, it's not. It's just what I do. So, yeah, I don't worry about it now. But I still wonder if people really understand it, because they're coming from a sighted angle and trying to imagine. So, I don't know, but I like it. So. And the other thing that surprised me is that I knew, talking to blind people and other disabled people, they would be inspired to have a go or at least do that. But it really surprised me that sighted people came up to me and said, you really inspired me. You really, you really showed me that I can have a go. And that surprised me. Well, you've got nothing wrong with me. But then I realized a lot of it's mental. A lot of it's about taking that first step and the fear of getting out your front door and doing something different, getting out your comfort zone, which I do every day. And that really surprised me. It was interesting.
Just the way it organically happened for you. Yeah, like you said, you didn't set out. It's just kind of, started happening and going in this direction, and it's inspiring people. So, hey, man, let's roll with this. You know?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the sort of the fear is a thing that can hold people back from traveling or whatever things in life. You know, there's a lot of this, of course, a big element of mindset type of stuff, right? And I guess one of the fears may be, you know, this idea that, hey, I'm going to go to this country and maybe it's represented in the media in a certain way. And you feel like, you know, you might get robbed, people might be out to get you. And maybe there's some element of like being afraid to trust strangers. And this can happen like to any traveler, right? No matter how seasoned, you get to a place and you're like, you know, you have to decide like kind of who you're going to trust, who you're not. You know, is this person going to scam me? Is this person like being authentic and wanting me to take me here and show me this thing? I mean, if you've traveled long enough, everybody's been scammed at some point, I feel. You really have like a next level, I feel, of having to put your trust into people to kind of take you places, show you. Can you just talk about that experience? Because that is different.
This is what's so interesting, because people always imagine, oh, if you're blind, you're partially deaf, you're traveling. That must be scary. That must be dangerous. So you're not vulnerable. But it's actually the other way around, at least in my head. I'm less vulnerable in some ways because I've had to trust people all my life. I've had trust people from a very young age to help me cross the road, to give me good directions, to not rob me. So this is where being blind has an advantage, because I've learned those skills to trust people, to listen to what they say, the way they say things, the way they react to meeting a blind person. Do they panic? Do they say patronizing things because they don't know how to communicate to a blind person? Are they relaxed and natural? And I've learned over 30, 35 years of, you know, making mistakes and getting it wrong. And I've learned how to work out who I can trust by, you know, listening to them and sensing their energy and stuff. So I think that's why I have an advantage. And I have less choice when I'm traveling. I have to have help. I can't get around not having help to use a cash machine or to get on a bus if I want to go from A to B. So it's probably slightly easier for me. And I'm also born, or my mum's very positive and I'm very positive, and maybe naively, but I look at people and I look at the world as in a positive aspect. I think that most people just want to put food on the table for their family, a roof over their house, and not much more. And sure, you're going to get the odd asshole who wants to take advantage of you, or someone who's so poor they'll rob you because they need to sell it just to get food. But I think, you know, 95% of the population of the world are, like I say, just want an easy, simple life. Well, that's how I look at people. I mean, that allows me to trust people a little easier. And also, people trust me, particularly. I mean, women trust me more because they sense I'm not looking at them as a sexual object. I don't see them. So therefore, they tend to relax around me and open up more. Yeah. And of course, the other great thing about being blind is I'm not visually racist. So I interact with people from different cultures in an easier way, maybe.
Can you share some of your most memorable interactions with locals, just as a traveler, you know, some of the experiences you've had around the world, meeting people? There's like a montage of people going through your brain right now, right?
it's just a generic one. I stayed in Armenia recently and I met this lady, she's a tour guide, her name's Hasmik, and she was my tour guide and we did several tours together. And then she arranged for me accommodation, helped me find accommodation in different parts of Armenia up in the north. And I went to a city called Dilijan and I stayed in this hostel called Ojak, O-J-A-K-H. And one of the ladies there could speak English and her mother could speak a little bit. But they were so nice. They were so kind to me. They reduced the price of the dorm and they reduced the breakfast slightly and then they gave me dinner for free. It was so kind. And the daughter was talking to me and just asking me about my travels and my website and just things like that, little things really. And then I met an Indian guy who was in the hostel and we were meant to get a bus to go back to Yerevan. And the bus was full and 11 o'clock in the morning, it was the only bus going back to Yerevan. And to get a taxi would have cost me 10,000 local money, which is probably about $25. So I suggested hitchhiking. So this Indian guy helped me find a car. And then I offered the local guy, he took me to the next bus station and I offered him a bit of money and he just said no. And it's things like that, people like that. I met another guy called, it was in Zambia, and I couch surfed with him. Like, he's a couch surfing website where you can stay with people. And I stayed with him for a few days and then offered him some money for milk and stuff. I said, no. And then I got stuck because I was meant to go from Zambia to Namibia. And then the borders closed because of COVID. So I called him and I said, I need to come back for a couple of days. And he said, stay as long as you want. You know, things like that are fantastic.
Yeah, so much kindness out there on the road.
Yeah. That's why I've sort of had traveling around the world for the last 20 years.
What has solo travel taught you about yourself?
That's mostly how I've traveled since I started, really. Traveling by myself. And for me, I love it because it allows me the freedom to go anywhere I want, when I want. I don't have to compromise like when I travel with my girlfriend. We do it differently. She's also blind and she's a lot smaller, a bit delicate. So we have to compromise and, she might not want to get up at 7 a.m. and go hiking. But when I'm by myself, I can make those decisions or not. And also it gives me I don't have to book everything. I don't have to plan a trip as much. When I went to Australia the first time, I put my first hostel online, just started to use the internet. And then I got to Australia and I, got a taxi to my first hostel. And I just asked the hostel staff, what's there to do? How can I book tours? I'm going to this city. And you book the next hostel. And it was so easy traveling around Australia because I could speak the language and the infrastructure. And they just booked every hostel for me. And then, now I've gone to Africa and Asia. I still travel by word of mouth, even though we've got the internet and a lot of people use smartphones and stuff. I don't. I just carry a basic little phone with tactile buttons so I can call each couch surfer. I take my laptop, but that's how I go with it. And it just, and also when you travel with someone, especially if you travel with someone with sight, which I've done a couple of times during my trips, and you're asking people, how do we get to this place? Or how much is it? They look at the sighted person, because someone's got to do us. And, you know, rather than, so I'm not getting the interaction that I would be when I'm traveling on my own. When I'm traveling on my own, I've got to talk to them, they've got to talk to me. So I enjoy it more. But it's not to say I don't like people and I don't like traveling with people, but I'm more one-to-one. You know, because when I got invited to do this conference in Armenia, the one thing I worried about, oh, God, there's going to be 40, 50 people. I'm really going to struggle to socialize. I don't really like groups. I've done a couple of trips with groups, and it's not for me. Fortunately, yeah, luckily, it was really good. The conference people took the time to speak to me into my ear one-to-one, so it was that was good. I guess they're experienced travelers, which helped, but I do prefer solo traveling because it's the ultimate freedom for me.
It's awesome. It's a great way to travel. You could argue that, you know, you mentioned kind of solo travel. Like, it's not that I don't like people, but like you could almost argue you solo travel because you do like people, right?
Yes,
like you get to meet more people. Because when you're traveling with somebody else, you're more present with them, which of course makes sense. You're on a trip together, but.
Yeah, you're more. Yeah, you cut yourself off more when you're traveling with your partner. Yeah, you don't interact as much. And people say to me, oh, don't you get lonely? I say, how do you get lonely? There's 7 billion people to meet.
Well, I mean, when you travel with your girlfriend, are you like, all right, you know, I have to mentally prepare myself for this now because I'm used to being able to do whatever I want all the time.
No, you just have to be more patient. And the good thing about being in a relationship is you do become more patient. You become less selfish, which is a good thing.
Where did you guys meet?
We met through the internet. A Greek journalist, because she's Greek, she lives in Greece. A Greek journalist did an article about me back in 2008, and she found it online, and she liked the way I described things from an on-site person's point of view. Like described the, you know, touching a church and the different layers of stone and different textures and stuff, and walking through cobbles and narrow streets. And so she emailed me, and I went, oh, nice girl. I emailed back, and I think she just emailed me to sort of improve her English really to start with. And then she had me kidney transplant 2009, went to Turkey for a month. I'd never been, been to Turkey, I should go to Greece because of her history. And I said, oh, I'm coming to Greece. So we met up and I found this little restaurant near the hostel I was staying, and she wouldn't let me pay. I remember that. She refused to let me pay for dinner. Oh, this is good. And then we just talked and we met up again. And then, 2010, I came back from a trip to the States and Canada. And we met up more. I went back to Greece to meet her. Just went from there slowly. And we've been together maybe 13 years next month.
Wow. Well, I mean, but the first time you met up, that must have been, it must have been a bit nervous, man.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'd never had a girlfriend. I mean, I'd, you know, been with people, but I'd never had a, anything lasted more than 4 days or something. So, yeah, I suppose it was nervous. I mean, we chatted through email, so we had something. It wasn't like a blind, well, it was a blind date, but to blind people. But, yeah, so we just talked, really, and, you know, and talked about Greece and each other, and then we, it's happened slowly. I met her again. I got invited to her house for a meal, and we sort of found it over sort of 2 weeks, me on and off, that we like the same music and a few other things, and it just went from there. And we met again, and she came to England and met my parents. So 6 months after that, and I met her mom, and
then it's going next level when you start meeting the parents.
Although I never really thought much about it to start with. Just grew naturally, I suppose. Things we didn't like, and we discovered more. Yeah, and I showed I had to slow down when I'm traveling with her because she didn't walk at my pace and not do the main mistakes. Like, I met some friends one night. The last night we were together as he was going home, and I thought, oh, let's meet some friends. And she just wanted to spend the night with the evening with us. You just learn as you go, don't you? Really? Especially when you can't see the facial reaction. So you've got to work it all out by the silences or the, I don't love you, or whatever. It's good fun.
I guess you could feel those energy shifts in conversation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's learning to read them.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected, and I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning, and you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled babbel.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, you lovely listener, it's Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast. And we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value, totally free. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show. What are some cultures outside of your home country that you identify with, that you kind of vibe with when you get there?
I really like the Latin culture. I went to South America. One of my friends, I met at uni doing my master's in 2002-03. She said she'd spent a year in Ecuador. That's how she described it more. Well, that sounds fun. So I went away for 4 or 5 months in South America, and I'd heard a bit about it, and about football and stuff, and a lot else about the Amazon. I went to Brazil, and it was crazy. I landed in Rio de Janeiro, and it was raining, and it was, you know, 90% Fahrenheit, 90%, and it was, people took me out samba dancing, and we pissed out the country. I'd only been there 4 hours. We go samba dancing all night. And like when you go to a bar in the States or in Europe, you know, it goes around 11. We turned up this bar at like 11:30 and there was nothing. It was closed. It didn't open until midnight. And they party till 5 in the morning. But that was different. And then, yeah, I found the people in South America amazing. Very sensory, very touchy-feely, very emotional, very open.
Passionate.
Passionate. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, me too.
They spoke, and people would just come up to me and touch my hand, and I didn't speak much English, Spanish. I remember sitting in a bus station in Venezuela, went for a bus that was late, and this guy just put me on his little stool next to his cafe shop. And these people just kept coming up and asking me if I was all right in Spanish and touching my hand, and someone bought me a coffee and just put it in my hand. And, I wish I could have learned more Spanish. I could have, communicated more on a deeper level. But I went back. I went back to Venezuela twice. Went back to Argentina and Chile 2 times. And I've been all over South America. It's a different atmosphere, a different vibe. And the same with Africa. Africa is my favorite continent. And the first time I went to Africa was 2004. I flew into South Africa with no real idea where I was going. I had a rough idea to try and get from South Africa to Egypt in 4 months. No chance. I was still in Malawi. 4 months. But I didn't know how big the continent was. I didn't know how complicated it was. And you ask for a taxi in Zambia, and you say, oh, coming now. And you think, oh, 5 minutes. And an hour later, you're still waiting for this taxi. And I learned very quickly, Africa is just so different. And I loved it. And I went back. And the chaos and the fact everything breaks down. I was on a minibus in Zimbabwe, I think. It was 25-seater minibus. There were 40 people on it. No windows, no glass. It's bouncing along. Dust, the heat, music's going boom, boom, boom. There's live chickens on this bus and luggage. And suddenly, smell of fire. What? The engine's on fire. We stopped the minibus. Everyone piled out. Blah, 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 blah. And you're like, you think, oh, in America or Europe, you get a new bus, wouldn't you? Wait a bus to come up. No. They cool the engine off and made sure it's all right, and we all get back on.
Oh, gosh.
This is an eight-hour journey. Yeah, it's just West Africa, it's poor. It's so poor, and but people are so generous. I went to villages, and it's so safe, the villages. No one wanted to take your steal your laptop or your phone. They were just happy to see you. And there's people in the villages understand me more than people in the city, because members of their family were disabled, one leg or blind. I met a blind boy in Malawi, and he became blind from malaria. Yet he went to school and he was learning Braille, and he wanted to teach other blind children Braille. And that was remarkable. And he was probably happier than me, because all his friends in his village had looked after and helped him get around. And he was probably more happy than I was at the time. Interesting. And the more simple things I learned, the more simple things are, the more happier people seem to me. I went to the mountain country of Lesotho, which is basically dry mountains surrounded by South Africa. And the kids run around in the dirt naked. And there's one school, there's one building, a classroom, 40 kids in it. And when we all turned up, getting pencils and balloons, they just couldn't believe it. They're amazing. Never seen a balloon, little balloon go up before. And I just thought, this is simple. And then I went on this pony trek for 2 days, and we're up in the village, stone huts on this mountain. The guy said to me, Tony, the women have got up this morning at 6 a.m. They walked down the valley to 2.5 miles. One and a half mile. They collect water in buckets. They bring it back on their heads. They can't drop any water because that's all they've got to feed the village each day. And I thought, we don't know how lucky we are. We just turn a tap on and water. We don't think about it. And that really opened my eyes in many ways. Life can be simple, and a more simple life is a happier it probably be. Yeah.
You home base in England, right? You're not nomadic, are you?
No, I'm not nomad. I'd like to be, but because of my medical situation, I have to get checks every 3 months and medication every 3 months. So that my immune system's reduced, so I don't reject the kidney. And also having a partner, I mean, I couldn't be nomadic anyway.
Yeah. So you're usually, at least within every 3 months, you head back.
Yeah. So I'll do a trip for a couple of weeks or a month. And I go to Africa, I'll do a 3 month trip. But I like to land in a continent and try and do 2 or 3 countries at once. And it's the cheapest way to do it. And then I'll come home and I'll see my girlfriend. I'll go to Greece or she'll come here. And I plan the next trip. We'll plan a trip together, travel for a couple of weeks. We went to Australia in September for 3 weeks. I got invited to a travel conference for blind travelers and spoke there near Sydney. And then we spent a couple of weeks traveling around Oz. Yeah, that's how I kind of do it.
What are some of the countries you have left to visit that are kind of maybe a bit intimidating or complicated or just kind of like, I'm going to save that one for the end?
Yeah, the only countries that are slightly intimidating, but sort of troubling, is Equatorial Guinea, just because of the corruption. It's so corrupt, apparently. And getting visas is quite complicated for that one, I think. A lot of it means flying into each country, which I don't really like doing. I prefer sort of overlanding and doing it that way and all the hassle of that. India's going to be a big challenge just because the amount of people, more than anything. I went to Pakistan earlier this year, and that was amazing. And everyone just sort of treated me like family. They took me in and helped me go where I wanted to go. I imagine India would be the same, but just on a greater scale. The idea of trying to cross the road in India is
probably terrifying.
Yeah, not terrifying, just laughable. I did it in Vietnam, and it was like 5,000 cyclists going past the one. So you just move with the bicycles, and the gap naturally opens up, apparently. But what you can't see, you don't worry about so much. I think I have an advantage. Like people say, well, how do you cope walking into an airport and it's chaos? Well, I don't see it. Yeah, I can hear it. I know it's there, but I don't see it. It's not the same impact. And then I get special assistance. So I find someone take me to the check-in desk of whatever the airline, and then from there, they'll guide me through. We jump the queues, go through bits, and then take me through security to the gate and put me on the plane, and someone meets me at the other end. So it's very easy. In that respect, staff on the plane look after me. One lady on the on an airplane once, I was going to the Middle East on the way to the Philippines, and someone told the air, said, "Oh, he's blind and deaf." And she said, "Well, how do I communicate?" And I said, "Well, try speaking." So, Syria, that'd be a guided tour, I guess. I went to Libya last year, and that was fantastic. I was meant to go to Bhutan in 2020, and I was about to set off a guided tour, and my guy said, "Don't come because you'll be in quarantine for 2 weeks." A lot of it's just planning. It's
logistics, kind of the logistics.
And if you're sighted, you just, really cut the websites, pick a guidebook up, and you go. If you're blind, you need to plan it more. And like I say, I put my first accommodation in each country, and I need to research that what attractions are available, because I can't flick through a guidebook once and there to find out the currency and what can I get from the airport to my accommodation by taxi or public transport and all this stuff. And then, I just research more. That's it. I take my laptop with me. But I still ask people on the way, because when you're in Africa or Asia, sometimes you don't have any electricity or internet for 3 days. But I was sitting in Gambia one night having a meal with a bunch of other guests, and they said, suddenly the lights had gone out. I said, and I carried on eating. And they went to find the candles.
Do you get reverse culture shock when you come home?
Yeah, a little bit.
Do you? In what way?
I go home and close the door for 4 days. And,
do you?
I don't want to meet anyone. I never really completely unpack.
No.
Washing it, but half the stuff stays in the backpack, really. It's bizarre. Oh, especially landing in London, and everyone's miserable.
It's like charming miserable, though, right?
Isn't that kind of English? Yeah. English being English. Yeah.
I've learned a lot more about like the culture in England, I guess, and that sort of side of it, because I think just being in Europe and being closer and being exposed to more British TV shows and things like that, and humor and everything, and I've come to really appreciate it, actually.
And then you hear the news, you put the news on, we've got a new prime minister again. Yeah. Prime Minister in like 6 months, whatever it is. And the shock. The biggest thing at the moment, is you go away for 2 weeks and you buy milk and the price has gone up. It's gone up another 20p again yesterday. Like, my God, that's the big thing that you notice at the moment. The price of the petrol pumps, and that's the main thing you're going to notice now. They must be going from all quiet, gentle, almost miserable Norway. And always come across miserable when you first meet them.
is that the energy in Norway?
Yeah. They just keep themselves to themselves. They're very...
They do.
Maybe Oslo apart, but once you go, it's just very reserved. But then you sort of realize it's them being them, they're not being rude. But for you, you're quiet Norway, and then you go to America, and you're bombarded by everything, especially if you land in New York or LA, you're bombarded by advertising everywhere and lights and noisy Americans who don't, ask you stupid questions.
like what? I got to hear.
How did you get here? Aeroflame.
Overall, though, would you say my home country, America, have we been all right? We've been all right to travel through.
When I was young and naive and didn't really realize you were. No, most people are very kind and very friendly. They're just OTT at times. It's just over the top.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it, I'd say.
Yeah, and it's...
very sensational.
Yeah, it can be. It's a shock at first. When I was studying there, living in England, you've got one choice of bread or two, and... two, three types of cheese. You go to the States the first time, and I'm walking in the supermarket with my friend. I want to get bread and cheese and some ham. I get brown bread. Tony, you got about 10 different types of brown bread and 20 different types of cheese. And he's just like, can I go home? You get 20 different choices as a man. Oh, that's a struggle.
It's funny. I'm actually reading this book called The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. Have you read that?
No, I got to read that. Is it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I mean, you know, one of the main premises, I mean, they're using science to back it up and everything like that. But the core concept is that the more choices we have, the more kind of miserable we are as humans.
So right? I was trying to say earlier, yeah, less choices. That's
kind of the idea.
Mm. And I think that's what young people struggle with today. They got too many choices. When my parents were growing up, they didn't have the choices. When they saved money because they had to, you know. They couldn't put the heating on all the time. The toilets are outside. I was in Armenia and it was freezing, the outside toilet. Even my mum, I said, how did you cope back in the 50s, outside toilet? You know, they were tougher then. It's spoiled for choice today.
I actually hadn't thought about this in regards to pursuing the every country goal, but perhaps, you know, because there's so much to see in the world. So you could think, oh, well, this is overwhelming. There's so many choices. But maybe committing to going to every country in the world, perhaps because you're sort of now you're like, you got a mission, right?
Yes,
maybe that takes away from the overwhelming.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yeah.
The people say, ways. I don't know.
How do you choose which country to go next? Well, you find the one that sounds most interesting and, you know. And not every country is interesting, by the way. I mean, there's not a lot to do and see in Liechtenstein, for instance. It really isn't. I mean, unless you go mountain climbing, there's not a lot to get excited about. And where else? Burkina Faso is some of it, but it's not. You're not going to be clubbing and partying away every night in Burkina Faso. Yeah.
If we're coming to England, where should we go? What should we do?
Going to England?
Yeah.
Well, you could spend a month in London and never be bored. I mean, and you could do London cheaply. That's the thing that people moan about. Oh, England's expensive. But London, you can do it cheaply. But the parks are free. So in April, May, June, the parks are lovely. You can go to most of the museums that are free. The British Museum's really interesting. Got a fantastic audio guide. Tells you about all the artifacts that British have stolen from other countries over the last 300 years. Egypt and Greece and Turkey.
I think they've started to return some of those, actually.
The lesser sort of, yeah.
Museum is that?
The British Museum.
Yeah, okay.
Central London. And then you've got the War Museum, of course. You know, World War One, World War Two. That's fascinating for people like me. I'm really interested in war history, quote unquote. And what else? You got the Science Museum. You got the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is all kinds of bits and bobs. Transport Museum, and they're all free to go to. You spend hours in each one. British Library, and then you got things. You can go climb the monument, and you got famous churches to visit, famous cathedrals like St. Paul's. Again, they've got probably the best audio guide I've ever used. St. Paul's Cathedral, central London. And then there's also Westminster Abbey. So all the kings and queens are buried in Westminster Abbey. And all the sort of military personnel are sort of buried in St. Paul's. The two most important cathedrals in London. There's so much. And then, of course, you could do day trips to Brighton, which has got a pebbly beach, and there's a lot of hippies living in Brighton and get a tattoo or your belly button pierced. Or you could go to Reading for the day, and Legoland, or you could go to Windsor. They're all sort of like a 30, 40 hour trip from London. Or you can go to Oxford from London, where the ancient university is. You can go down to Dover, the cliffs, to Canterbury Cathedral. There's so much to do in London and around, and Cambridge as well. You know, you can have a place in England like Bath, the historic Roman baths. You can get a tour around that. You go to Bristol, the history of the railway and the docks, and there's a big museum there called the M Shed, all about the history of the docks. And you go to Birmingham and find out about the Industrial Revolution. There's so much. Liverpool for the Beatles, of course. And you can come down to my way into Devon, the county of Devon and Cornwall. Lovely beaches and lots of nature, lots of walking, lots of very, very big steep hills. And then you go to Scotland, and that's beautiful. There's just so much in this little island. I'm actually discovering more and more about the UK now than I ever did when I was young.
Well, doesn't traveling kind of make you appreciate things back at home a bit more, I feel?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, you know, people say, oh, what do you miss about England? And I think, oh, I miss listening to the radio. There's one radio station I listen to called BBC Five Live, and I can get listen to the sport, the football, or soccer, as we call it in the States, and cricket in the summer, and the news as well. And I miss that when I'm traveling, you know, 2 or 3 months. I miss sausages. There's nothing, no one would get a sausage like the English. And I miss my small little beach.
Well, if you want to hear a great sausage joke, well, oh, yeah. Again, you have to watch the TED Talk because it's very funny. The last time I went to London, I didn't realize, like, so at the British Library, for example, the things you can see for free just in the library, you're like,
yes,
oh my gosh, it's like they got the Magna Carta here. You see, like, something that Shakespeare wrote. It's yeah. Insane. It's so inspiring.
Then you go see a copy of the Magna Carta, which is it's the founding block of democracy. So there's so much. Like going to the States, and especially if you're blind, you got to touch the Liberty Bell because we can't see it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
See, I'm from Philadelphia. That's where I grew up, in the Philadelphia area. So that's cool.
The big crack.
Did you touch the crack?
I touched the crack. Yes.
Very cool.
I told my girlfriend not to ring it, though. She would play with the knocker.
Don't ring this bell.
Yeah, don't ring this bell.
Don't crack it anymore.
Yeah, have a revolution. Yeah, stuff like that.
Do you have certain experiences that you really enjoy through touch?
Yeah, so when I'm planning a trip, well, myself as well, but especially when I'm traveling, planning a trip for me and my girlfriend, we go to cities, we try and find free walking tours so we can hear the information, listen to the guy and the history. But we're not distracted by the visual architecture. I also try and find fountains we can listen to and statues we can touch. Like when we went to Dublin, there's a lot of statues of famous people we could touch. We touched one of James Joyce, the writer, and he's a little guy stood on a block of stone. And we can feel him all and feel his face and his hair with our fingers and get a real picture of what he kind of looked like through our fingers. That's fantastic. So things like that.
Can you think about a fountain you've listened to that you really kind of struck you or inspired you in some way?
I really love the fountain in Alexanderplatz in Berlin. It's the eastern side of Berlin. And it's lovely sound. It's also got these 4 semi-naked women sat around it with fish and baskets of grapes. And you can just play with them for hours. You can really feel them all. You feel the detail of the grapes and the fish, the whole shape of the fish. And you're walking around it. And again, you've got the water. And I also like waterfalls. I mean, I love the best waterfall I've ever been to is Iguazu Falls on the Argentine-Brazil border. And the reason you can get so close to it, you walk up these metal ramps and you're right on top of it. And the absolute crescendo, this volume of water just drops over the cliffs. And then you're feeling the spray in your face. And yeah, that's the best waterfall I've been to. I've been to Niagara at the time. So you get behind the curtain and stuff. Angel Falls is amazing for its hike. It's a bit disappointing in some ways because you don't get that close to it. Highest waterfall in the world.
Incredible. You've been a few places, man.
A few.
Maybe we can leave it at this. What is your best one or two pieces of travel advice?
Decide where you want to go. Do your research. Planning is the key, particularly if you're disabled. But even if you're not, planning is the key. I always try to have a backup plan. So when I go, particularly when I go to a country where English isn't the first language, or even the second language, like Russia, I really have to plan it. I booked all my train tickets in advance because I knew someone no one in the train station would speak English. But once we had our ticket, we could just show someone and they could read the Russian and just put us on the train. That's the main research, planning, and have fun. But that's what it's about in the end of the day. There's a lot of work goes into traveling, but it should be about having fun. You're doing it because you want to, hopefully.
Well, I had fun today, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and to share, you know, how you see the world your way and, you know, the advice you've given and some of the destination stuff. I really enjoyed the conversation, man. We're going to link up to all this stuff. Let's do it in person sometime. I don't know. It doesn't sound like you have the best impression of Norway. I don't know if you'll be back here anytime soon, but
yeah, I like it. I like Bergen. I really like Bergen.
You like Bergen? I mean, you know, hey, I love coming to England. So yeah, next time I get over there.
If you're ever in the UK, let me know if I'm here. Yeah.
Show me some spots and appreciate your time and thanks again. There you have it. Thank you once again to Tony Giles for stopping by the show. Of course, you can check out any of the links in the show notes. TonyTheTraveler.com is his website. Excited to stay in touch with him and keep following along on his adventures. Would love your thoughts on this interview or the show in general. If you ever want to get in touch, you can always reach me via email or drop me a voicemail. Leave a link in all the show notes. And if you haven't signed up over at ZeroToTravel.com yet, you can sign up for the newsletter there. It's free. Send one out every week now. And really enjoying getting the newsletter out to all of you. So stay in touch off the podcast. Would love for you to take a moment and sign up over there if you haven't done so. One quick thing before I leave you with a quote and send you off. I mentioned at the top something that pumped me up that Tony said. He was talking about travel and he just said, if you don't want a challenge, then go home. And just like love that tough love sometimes, you know? So next time you're out on the road and you're facing some challenges, you can hear Tony's voice saying, well, if you don't want a challenge, then go home. Maybe that'll empower us to face that challenge and overcome it. Just pump me up. Anyway, also one of the things that stuck with me is just that idea of moving through the world and utilizing all of your senses. So if you want a bit of a task or something to try out today, get out and engage all of your senses and see where that takes you. Now I'm going to leave you with a quote from Helen Keller, who said, "One can never consent to creep when one feels an impulse to soar." Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.